I'm very excited to introduce you all to Alan Cooper. Some of you have spoken with Alan before, some have not. So we're going to be focusing on HR talent recruiting and all the wonderful best practices that are out there that Alan's been leading and driving for quite some time in different organizations. Alan, if you can hear us, please can you introduce a little bit of your background to the group?
Sure. Thank you, Roy. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining me at 8 a.m. At least it's not a Friday or a Monday. So again, my name's Alan Cooper. I am a non-traditional HR person, I would call myself. So I started out actually getting a PhD in experimental psychology and getting and falling into healthcare. What I meant by that was I was a paramedic as a volunteer, was backing an ambulance into a hospital one morning while I was waiting to before I went to school to college, and the director of the emergency room said, "You want a job?" So I took a job as a part-time paramedic and have been in healthcare ever since. So I worked for what's now Northwell Health in New York. The largest health systems in the tri-state area. I worked there for 21 years, starting out again as a paramedic in the emergency room, and winding up being vice president of what they called the Center for Learning and Innovation. And what you're going to hear from my talk is the Center for Learning and Innovation was the education arm of the hospital, of the health system, which is now, I think, 22 or 23 hospitals. When I was there, it was 15 hospitals. And we oversaw HR. So unlike traditional human resources structures where education came under HR at North, at what that time it was North Shore LIJ, HR came under education. So I have a strong bias towards towards education. The way we wound up becoming in charge of HR was we complained a lot about it. When I ran I ran EMS before I was coming up there as a director of EMS, which was 300 paramedics and EMTs and 60 ambulances, and I kept complaining about human resources, saying they don't do things, they don't hire people for us in time, and they send us terrible candidates, and I just kept complaining and complaining and complaining. And they said, "Fine, you want to do something about it? You're now in charge of human resources," which was a great strategy by the CEO, and I learned a lot, but I taught a lot. And what I mean by that is I am, and as I just said before, not the traditional HR person. I was an operations person, again, having 300 employees in my department. So I learned the traditional HR stuff, but I ran HR as a more from an operations standpoint than a transactional standpoint. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes. After leaving 21 years at North Shore LIJ, I started my own consulting business, and then wound up being insourced at White Plains Hospital in Westchester, as their the title was Chief People and Performance Officer, and Chief People Officer was the Chief HR Officer, and I spent a few years there turning around their HR department, their education department, and flipping things. So again, a non-traditional HR. My educational background, like I said, I have a PhD in experimental psychology, a master's, an MBA, and a master's in education. So combining all those, it's more like an organizational development role. So that's me in a nutshell. Would
Thank
you
you.
sure?
Helpful intro. So let's kick off with some questions. So as we normally do, I come with a prepared list of some questions, and then invite the rest of the group to pepper you with their random thoughts and insights. So we'll do the same. So let's get into the weeds of operational HR versus transactional HR.
Sure, I love that question. So, and I love that question because it's really it's really the roots of what people think about HR versus what HR should be, and in a lot of organizations, what HR is. So transactional HR is keeping the trains running, right? People have to get hired, people have to get their proper paperwork, people have to take their mandated topics. In some industries, healthcare being one of them, people have to get reviews, people have to get terminated, people have to get disciplined. People have to have time and attendance records, people have to be compliant with state laws and federal laws. So that's transactional HR, and that's the way HR came about. So back in the day, it was the personnel department, right? There was no such thing as human resources. It was, you would go to the personnel department, and it was usually somebody who had failed in every other aspect of the organization, sitting at a desk, who everybody didn't like because it meant you were bad. It was like being called to the principal's office if you had to go to personnel. And that's where you went if you had a problem. That's where you went if there was something wrong with your benefits. That's where you went if you didn't get paid right. That's where you went if you were in trouble. So the transactional piece of HR, like I said, keeps the trains running. And hopefully it keeps them running well, right? It's hiring, onboarding, and that piece. But what HR should be, and again, the difference that I draw between transactional HR and strategic HR is what HR should be. HR should have a seat at the table. So when I was elevated from being a department director to HR and education, the position wasn't mine at the time, but reported directly to the CEO, right? So a lot of organizations, the chief HR officer, if you haven't have a title of chief HR officer, a lot of people just have a director of HR that reports to somebody that reports to somebody that reports to the CEO. But if it's a strategic position, it has to have a seat at the table. It has to be a C-suite level position that will work with the top leadership to develop strategy from an operational perspective. So what I mean by that is, how many people do you need to hire this year, for what positions, and what are the outcomes? What are the goals? How do they align with the top of the organization? How are you going to attract, retain, those employees? One of the first things I did when I was brought up to White Plains Hospital was I went department by department to review the tables of organizations for each department. Did they have the right people to do the job? Did they have enough people? Did they have too many people? Were the skill sets appropriate? Were the competencies appropriate? And so forth. So a strategic HR perspective is, how does human resources help? And I hate that word, by the way, the term human resources. How does that department help the organization succeed? Again, how do we bring in the right people? How do we bring in enough of the right people? Who are the right people? How do we know they're the right people? When a job is empty, do they just fill somebody quickly so they don't have to pay overtime, which happens all too often? So again, transactional, got to keep the trains running, got to have the employees hired and paid and compliant. Strategic, how does HR work with senior leadership and the entire organization to make sure that you have the right people with the right competencies, the right skill sets to succeed in the organization?
We're going to go through the different functions because we've all seen wide variance in execution across every one of these functions, from sourcing to onboarding to training to performance evaluations to professional development and mentorship, wide variance. Before we go into each of them, in your mind, how do you frame something like a C-suite function for HR and each of these functions performing at optimal levels vis-a-vis the different sizes of organizations that you've come across and that, frankly, you've worked with us? I'm not sure that the full package of HR, talent management, education, and operational HR solutions is applicable for a business doing, you know, $5 to $10 million of revenue with 3 to 5 positions. And perhaps at 20 to 40 or 50 million of revenue, you're looking for certain infrastructure versus at 500 million of revenue versus where you spent 20 years, which is, you know, several billion dollars of revenue. So how do you frame the right solution for the right size organization?
So that's a great question. So, and again, since being with you, I've worked with a number of organizations for different sizes, and you know, before you, of course, I have as well. I've worked with single practices to develop these types of roles. I've worked with single physician practices to develop these types of functions. So, I think the answer is that it's very scalable. I think to be a successful organization, you need at some level all of these functions. And what do I mean by all of these functions? So if you look at the entire, and I'll throw a term out there that we haven't hit yet, but if you look at the entire talent management spectrum, if you look at talent acquisition, onboarding, development, performance management, succession planning, workforce planning, all the strategic things that I'm talking about, it sounds like, yeah, you need a $5+ billion organization with multiple sites, but you really don't, right? You need the right person doing it. And that's key, right? So if you have a multi-billion, multi-site, multi-state organization, you need a team, a fairly large team, in order to accomplish this. But if you have a small, I would argue a single practice, and again, I've done this at single practices, if you have somebody there that can do this at a smaller level, it still needs to be done, right? So and we'll talk, I'm sure you're gonna ask me later about why, right? So what are the advantages? Why do we need this? But you may not have a robust program, and you may not be able to do it all yourself. So you may need to outsource performance management, or you may need to outsource your development and your education. But again, I would argue that it's very scalable. And so again, from single practices to multi-billion-dollar organizations, you just do this at different levels and different depths. And it's all about the people, right? So this is a specialty, but it's something a lot of people think they know how to do, right? The other thing is a lot of people don't see the importance in it, right? Which again, I think you'll ask me in a little bit. So you may have a 20 practice MSO and say, oh, you know, I don't need all those functions. I just need somebody to get the people hired, you know, source them and hire and onboard, and then, you know, and get them benefits and make sure they get paid, and that's fine. And that's fine if you want high turnover and low quality employees. That is fine, but that will cost you a lot of money in the long run. So I think so again, you may say, though, if you have 5 practices, 20 practices, 1 practice, it's not really worth it, but it definitely is. And again, sometimes a lot of this needs to be outsourced, but at the larger organizations, it definitely needs to be insourced.
Can you give us some examples of, I mean, we can all imagine strong compliance departments, you know, annual surveys of harassment, and we can all imagine a certain level of performance evaluation, 360 reviews, some degree of training, some degree of sourcing. We've all been exposed to some levels of each of these functions in different stages in our career in different companies. Where can you describe some of the gaps between what is best practice versus what you see in each of these functions? What do those gaps consist of, starting with sourcing?
Sure. So sourcing is a very interesting concept where, you know, people think of it as different things. But it depends on what you're looking for. There are your normal channels. Everyone loves LinkedIn now. The key to sourcing is, again, the right channels, the right places. But what really makes it is what I call a talent pool, right? So if you have to source each specific job, it becomes, to different places, obviously, it becomes a task that you have to complete. But if you have a pool of talent, and that can be internal or external, that you can pick from, that's a best practice, right? So if you have talent management software, right? You heard, you know, customer relations management, CRM. Now we have talent relations management and candidate relations management. So sourcing, in my opinion, is not a single task when you have a job. It's a an ongoing relationship with either sources or talent themselves. So if you, again, build that out in your organization, no matter how large or small you are, you have, so again, a best practice would be to have that talent pool to call on instead of treating each hire as a as an episodic event. That's really, and multiple sourcing, again, hitting the targets for that position, knowing where to get the best candidates for each position that you're looking at. You know, some people use some of you have seen this, I'm sure, they use the oatmeal approach. They just source everywhere, right? They just throw it against the wall and see where somebody applies. Well, you're wasting money in that respect. So targeted sourcing, I think is the best practice. And again, what I see a lot of is, and especially in today's labor market, is scrambling, and just throwing the oatmeal against the wall and seeing where you get your applicants. And it doesn't always result in the best candidates.
So same question for training, performance evaluation, and mentorship.
So we could do 5 hours on training and performance evaluation. But so best practices. So let me get on my soapbox for a minute. There's a difference between training and learning. So if the job requires training, that's very so training is very passive, compliant, it relies on a very fixed mindset, it's something to tick the box. So we do sexual harassment training so we can comply with that and check the box that all our employees have received sexual harassment training. Learning is a completely different process. Learning is active. It employs a growth mindset where you actually change your behavior after you learn something, right? So best practices in learning is really learning, right? Most people unfortunately don't take that seriously. They see it as everyone says mandated topics. You know, check the box. That's what we do for training. Which again, I think is a huge lost opportunity. So what you need to do is have everything aligned, right? So when you're onboarding somebody, or when you're from the time that the job is created, and people say job descriptions, I say, why do you need to describe the job? You need to describe what the person needs to know for the job. So I'm much more of a fan of the competency model. What are the competencies the person needs? And then what are the competencies the person needs to develop in that role? And one of the other things in a best practice education and training, and there is a role for training. If you need to teach somebody to take a blood pressure, that's training. You train them how to take a blood pressure. The best practice model there is, again, a job specific education and training onboarding, and a succession planning from day one. Whether you are a single practice or a $5 billion organization, you should be looking at every employee that you bring in, where they are now, what they need to know to do their job now, what they need to know to do their job better, and what they need to know to advance in your organization. Because whether you're a front desk clerk or an MA or an RN or an MD, what's your next move? How are you going to develop those employees so that they help you in your organization and that you keep them and reduce turnover? I know I missed the second part of that question, Roy. I apologize. Can you ask it again? I got on my soapbox of training versus learning.
That's a really good point. We very rarely see fully built out roadmaps for individual employees. And my view of a roadmap or a career plan is that every plan ever written is subject to deviation, but plans still have a value, have a role to play in setting expectations, in giving guidance, direction, stability. And so the fact that these career plans are mostly absent, I think puts us in the camp of a little too much ambiguity when it comes to individuals and their needs. We hear this point mentioned again and again and again, that a lot in life is solved through communication. And there's few things that individual employees want more than clarity on what the future might bring, and expectations from above and and around them. What do you see normally missing in performance reviews? I purposely didn't use the word annual because I don't want to presume that they should all be annual. But what usually are the gaps there?
Right. So my first my first ever experience with a performance review was my boss leaving a sheet of paper on my chair and saying, here's your review. I put a note on it. He didn't say it. There was a note on it. Here's your review. Sign it and leave it on my desk.
My first memory is my boss doing the same thing, except the paper was blank and the request was in yourself.
Fill it out, right? Yeah, fill it out. I've seen that too. I've seen that recently, actually. So people see performance reviews as something they have to do. It's like, oh my God, we have to do reviews again. What a pain in the butt that we have to do these reviews again. So I think the biggest issue with performance reviews, which all the smaller issues stem from, is people don't see the value in them, right? So people don't see the value in them. And I couldn't agree with you more. If you do it once a year, there is no value in it. It's just for compliance. It's just to comply with that you did an compliance evaluation. But so let me get back to my bias. Education. Employee reviews are all about developing the employee. They're all about developing the employee to what they need to be and what you need them to be. What do you need out of this employee? What is your front desk receptionist doing well? What could they do better? And how do they get there? That's an employee review. So people don't see the value of it. And again, you can't wait for it for a year. They treat it as something they just have to do, get it over with, and move on. But what it actually needs...
To interrupt you, forgive me. But I think one of the challenges that our employees face and HR talent teams face is in the past, these things were very paper intensive, time intensive. And the big issue inside any organization is time. The number one scarce resource is time. And so there's a conflict there, which nobody ever resolved that effectively. Then we migrated to IT and SaaS online data gathering solutions. And presumably believing that our problems were solved. But what my experience has been with these solutions is A, they're incredibly cumbersome. B, they bundle everything into a singular portal for ease of training, I guess. And what you end up seeing is one usually third-party brand pushing even more aggressively compliance programs, administrative burdens, benefits related topics that are cumbersome and confusing, health benefits that are cumbersome and confusing. And included in that is our questions like employee surveys and your response. So what we're really doing throughout the year is actually educating our workforce to view outreach from HR as disruptive and inefficient. Uh-huh. And then wondering why certain key tasks that actually inherently are very value generating are being ignored, overlooked. It's a bigger problem than, hey, don't worry about all the mundane stuff that HR normally does, because we've got really exciting things that are very value generating, because it's all getting packaged in really annoying IT IT solutions and administrative asks. So what are your thoughts on that?
So yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So like I said before, so it's how is HR viewed, right? So HR is viewed as very transactional. And if something pops up from HR, you're still thinking back to the old personnel days, either I'm in trouble, I did something wrong, or I have to do something that I really don't want to do and it's going to take time away from the job that I need to do, right? So people don't see the value in it, right?
I was just going to say, I think one of the other things that I have never, it's been a disconnect with reviews, is that it's very one-on-one, right? So, or you know, you can do 360 reviews, which allows you to review up and down, but the feedback is individual. And I find that in reality, you know, outcomes are achieved by teams. Have you seen any creative review strategies that evolve beyond providing feedback to an individual. And I'll give you one example. We just started doing something internally where after a project is done, the team meets as a team and sort of critiques the project as a whole. And so indirectly, you find out, you know, what your role was and how you did, but you also sort of provide feedback as a unit. And I'm just wondering if you've seen any evaluation strategies mm-hmm. that evolve beyond feedback on from one individual to, you know, another individual.
So yes. So let me jump back for a second to the technology piece. So as some of you know, I'm a process person. I also have a background in Lean and Six Sigma. And it's not about the technology, it's about the process, right? So if you put a bad process on steroids, a bad process on technology is just putting a bad process on steroids, right? So I was involved in a very, very large PeopleSoft implementation where all they did was take the current processes in finance, purchasing, and human resources and put them into PeopleSoft. Nobody looked at the process. So that cumbersome 7-page employee evaluation was now just a cumbersome 7-page employee evaluation on steroids on your computer. So before I get into a fairly innovative approach that I've seen, what an employee evaluation should be, again, like I said, it's really something. It shouldn't even be called an evaluation. It's really, again, it's a developmental tool that should be one page at most. What does the employee do well? What could they do better? How could they do it better? In more words than that. And that's it. That's the evaluation. So you know who does an amazing job at employee evaluations? Or they used to. I haven't visited them in a while, but I was a big fan, a big student of Disney, right? And the Disney way. And Disney does a lot of things wrong, but they do a lot of things right. So this gets to Roy's point. Disney's employee evaluations are not annual. They're actually daily. Every employee receives a daily evaluation. Disney has secret shoppers walking around their parks constantly all day long. And they are observing employees. And they're actually management from other parks. So a manager from Epcot will be walking around Magic Kingdom or one of the hotels or downtown Disney. And you know, every employee wears a name tag. And they're constantly taking notes. And they're constantly giving daily feedback to their employees of what they've witnessed them doing well, what they've witnessed them not doing well, and then how can they improve what they didn't do well.
I guess the analogy would be you're a soccer coach and you give your players feedback once a year.
Great analogy. And I was a soccer coach.
It wouldn't really work, would it?
No, not at all. Well, remember that game 5 months ago? You know, you were in the wrong position and you should have passed it.
Instead, what you have is soccer coaches busily writing notes for professionals that are getting paid $20 million a year, critiquing their game live. Yeah. That's the gap. So I think HR and talent also misses another key task. And I think all of them miss this right across the board. If I was running HR and talent, I would ask, to what extent has our team this year sold, promoted, marketed how we've saved our people time and disruption? Mm-hmm. Because I think the number one source of resistance to HR and everything that it represents is a belief from most staff that what the company finds important, prioritizes, which is efficiency, productivity, results, HR doesn't. Right. It's an island unto itself. And I've come across many CEOs and many leadership teams that are reluctant to fight that battle with HR because words like compliance are thrown around and it's a different skill set. It's not a revenue generator, it's a cost center. And it's a distraction. So it's sort of decision-making is outsourced. Mm-hmm. And then you have this sort of this three-party system of senior management that's delegated to HR, who is running a riot over an employee base that, you know, has no one protecting their interests. Instead, if you inverse that and have the HR team sell themselves as representing their staff's interest by balancing things like compliance and reviews with equally important, if not at times more important things. There is no HR without a successful business, right? Everything goes down together. And so that balanced message is so critical. And I just never see it.
Right. So you're 100% right. You're right on. So there's a couple of reasons for that. One, so we started off by talking about the difference between transactional and strategic HR. And historically, HR has been transactional. And a lot of those transactions, again, are, I wouldn't say detrimental, but they're not, they don't help the employee do their job, right? HR should be helping the organization succeed. And a true strategic HR department, where it's all about the employee development, employee engagement is. However, the problem is there are some organizations out there that do a fabulous job with this, but there are far too many that don't. And far too many employees come from companies that don't. HR has historically been a very weak area. We still see it today. If you can't cut it in finance, or you can't cut it in management, or you can't cut it in marketing, but you still want to be in business, yeah, you go to HR. So many people have wound up in HR because they didn't want to get rid of them, but they really weren't cutting it operationally. All right, so go to HR. We see that in universities too. We see that in universities. If you look at top business schools, any business school, not even top business schools, and you look at the quality of the students in each of the concentrations, HR is at the bottom. And why? Why? It's all because of, again, this historical transactional HR. People don't like it. HR is always a head nodder excuse. How come you can't do this? How come we can't get people in here quicker? Oh, it's HR. And everybody says, yep. And they all nod their heads. Yep, it's HR. Yep, it's HR.
Yeah, I mean, it really has to, you really have to think about it every step, right? If you're running a very in-depth compliance program, what is the message you're sending your employees? Hey, we're in the business of finding non-compliant employees and punishing right. them. Now I want you to be my friend. So if I was running a very in-depth compliance program, I would start by prepping everyone what the goals are here. Hey, the goals are to elevate the organization as a whole. Hey, the goals are to find opportunities for training and improvement. Hey, you know, this is going to benefit you individually in the following ways. Right. Let me sell you on it before I ask you to do it. But instead, the easy way out is, we have a compliance program and you have to do it. Tough.
Right. And you have to do it by this date or you're going to be in trouble. And if you don't do it by that date, you can't work here anymore. So I find this issue with a lot of things outside of HR and inside of HR. But with HR, there's very rarely the why behind the what. And I love that term, the why behind the what. You know what you have to do, but why do you have to do it? Yeah. I know how not to harass people. Why do I have to go through this training? I know I shouldn't touch blood with bare hands. Why do I have to go through bloodborne pathogens? That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Right. So I know Jason asked the question regarding group performance. Do you have any thoughts on that before we open up to the rest of the group?
So, yeah. So actually I was going to get back to that. So I was working with a behavioral health organization. And they had a fairly unique performance management. Now, as Jason said, a 360, or what we now call a global evaluation, is a wonderful tool for development. However, it takes time and on everybody's part, the HR professionals part and the people giving the reviews part and compilation. So I'm a big fan of them, but not as a standard employee. Your review or evaluation, but this company did what I would call like a mini 360. So they did it every 6 months. My advice was maybe you should do it every quarter, and they would get feedback from the group or the team within which that each individual worked. And they had a very nice organizational structure. They had it very nicely grouped without being siloed and interactive, and they had a fairly sophisticated HR department where they had coaches who did other jobs. They didn't have full-time 100% coaches. And it would be like I said, a mini 360 at least four people that had input into the employee's evaluation. And again, there was no, this evaluation, by the way, there was no pay raise or bonus or anything tied to. It was all about, again, improvement. And in the beginning, like any other thing coming out of HR, everybody was very skeptical and leery of it and didn't like it and thought it was to get them in trouble. But again, that's HR's reputation. But it actually wound up being very successful. And after it was done for about 2 years, everybody actually looked forward to it. And they got input into others' evaluations as well. So it was a very successful, again, I would call them mini 360 or mini global assessments. Twice a year, everybody would get that.
It's interesting that we've been taught to apply patient or customer scores, patient satisfaction scores, patient promotion scores, but we don't necessarily keep running tabs on employee scores.
Right.
I can imagine a lot of management teams associate reviews with bi-directional discussions regarding compensation increases, and that's not something that a management team can support on a daily or even quarterly basis. It's just a high impact, cumbersome, complicated, highly analytical, who's getting what, and that's a gravitational pull towards an annual discussion. Mm-hmm. So important to try to delineate between those two things.
Also, but without a doubt, and I'm sorry, Roy, to cut you off, but they can be related, right? So your annual discussion about compensation bonus can be tied to goals and things that are discussed in reviews, but not tied directly during those evaluations.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to turn it over to the group now, but I think the challenge at hand is how do you sell the value generating opportunities, the upside, the differentiating attributes of a really successful HR and talent program to try to counteract the perception that it's just cost, and therefore the goal in HR is to minimize cost and then suffer all the consequences associated with that. But I want to turn it over to the group and see if there are any questions from any of our attendees this morning.
Alan, this is Suniti. I have a couple of questions for you. One, I think I put it in the chat box. I would like to hear your perspective because many a times, you know, people think that HR, when employees have real challenge or issues or working with the boss or whatever it may be in our organization, they want to get some help. But the perspective that, you know, I've heard both sides is that HR is really carrying the company story and they always just support the company, but they really are not there to help employees deal with whatever they may be dealing with within an organization. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. Yeah. And I saw that in the chat. That's a great question. Unfortunately, Suniti, too often that is the case. And again, historically, right, you think about the 30s and the 40s and the rise of, I guess you could call it capitalism, especially in the United States, where it was all about the bottom line and all about the profit margin. So who's working for the company? Sure, everyone. And HR is seen as one of the corporate departments, and again, so it's really a view we have to break because it's if it's done right. So if it's done the things we're talking about, right, with employee, I call them position ladders, right. So if HR is helping you succeed, right, if HR is helping you learn. Again, back to my education platform. If HR is helping you progress in the organization, then it's seen as your friend. Now, of course, it's always going to be seen as part of the organization, having the best interests of the organization in mind, or the company in mind. But it also has to have that split personality, like you're saying, and has to be seen as your friend. So how do you get people to see that? Well, you can't go and say HR is your friend. You know, I'm here from HR. I'm here to help, because people are going to say, yeah, right, sure. But again, it's all about how do you change the organizational culture to see HR as that not only strategic partner to the organization to help you succeed, but that strategic partner to the individual employee. And like I said, it's you have to get your paycheck on time and you have to have your health benefits. But that's a given. That's what you expect. Mm-hmm. When you talk about how do you engage employees, you have to exceed their expectations. So when your HR business partner or whoever is in charge comes and says, hey, Suniti, look, we know you're new here, but where would you like to be in 5 years and how can we help you get there? Wow, your head just spins and says that, well, this is a different type of organization.
I've got another one for you, just actually triggered a memory for me. It's funny, we never forget anything. We just need triggers to be reminded. My head of HR at Houlihan Lokey was actually a real town. And her office was permanently full. There was always someone in there 24 hours a day. And if I had to simplistically give a reason why she had such goodwill amongst the workforce of about 700 of us, she spent a lot of time on exhibitions. She spent a lot of time on finding people where to go to next. And in the world of investment banking, that comes up again and again and again. And I think that's another, to Suniti's question, another wonderful source of goodwill and redefining your identity as being an advocate is spending a lot of time and really curating wonderful solutions for people in their next protocol. And so you really are a career developer and sort of agnostic, somewhat agnostic about staying here versus going elsewhere. Whereas what I see normally is, hey, you better make it here. And if you don't, good luck, goodbye, buddy, which is not really a best practice.
And that's why I keep saying education. And you know, people say, again, you asked this question before, right? How is it scalable? Well, if you're a single, let's take the smallest microcosm of our world. You're a single physician practice, right? How do you do that? You do that when you hire the front desk receptionist, you ask them that question. Thank you for coming to work for us. We're so happy that you're here. We'd like you to stay with us. How can we help you with that? Well, I'd like to become a medical assistant. That's perfect, right? Because we hire, you know, and again, so you and the medical assistant wants to become an LPN or an RN or a PA or a physician. How do you keep them there? And then HR, all of a sudden, HR is your friend.
Yeah, career paths. I want to ask you about integration, because I think a lot of us think of HR as a centralized department that sits somewhere in corporate and, you know, almost like the mountain, everyone has to come to the mountain. Whereas the reality of a lot of our businesses is they're multi-site, they're in many cases multi-brand, they're multi-department. Does an RCM department need its own HR function? Does an HR function need to exist locally in any state or city that you happen to be in terms of workforce? And even more complicatedly, we're now dealing with corporates, multiple practices, and homes as well. So what should an HR function look like in terms of number of locations versus centralization?
So I'm a big fan of a hub and spoke model. Actually, one of our recent engagements, we put this in place. A few years back, probably more than I remember, HR came out with a new title called HR Business Partner, right? Some people using it before others. And what that became was an HR representative for your site or your region. So corporate HR is corporate HR. So if you're a multi-site, multi-state organization, you need some type of centralized HR for, and I have a term called compliance is crap, and there's a lot in that goes into that, but for those compliance things, for those regulatory things, for the high level policies, procedures, employee handbooks, so some type of, but then you need that regional or site depending on the organization and the number of sites. You know, you're going to have an HR business partner for every practice, but you may have an HR business partner for every region. Or every state, or you may have more than that. So everyone has their own feel, right? Especially if you're multi-brand, everybody has their own subculture. You know, I'm a big fan of an overarching corporate culture, which are your vision, your values, your behaviors, your expectations. But then regionalized or localized cultures, because nobody wants to be a robot and be Stepford wives to the parent corporation. So HR should work in the same way. So that regionalized HR is what I recommend, regionalized, statewide, site-wise. Again, you know, if you have a hospital, again, working in a hospital system, well, 15 hospitals had HR business partners that reported into corporate HR and in a direct line to the CEO of this individual hospital, which works really well. So you have your own person there. So again, regionalizing it, and by specific function, sometimes, you know, education or training by function, but not necessarily HR by function, unless you have a huge. So I worked with an organization that had it was a huge organization that had an 800 person IT department. So IT had their own HR business partner who reported to the CIO as well as the chief HR officer at corporate. So something that large, but for our normal business practices, it would not necessarily need to be by function. Education and training, however, again, hub and spoke model as well, but with educators or trainers in the specifics, again, specifically IT, CRM, that type of whatever they would need, but reporting in through a centralized education and training team that, again, keeps things standardized across the organization.
More questions?
Alan, I have one other question for you, because as you describe it, and you know, have it working through our careers, we know that the HR has become complicated in a way that there are a lot of different functions. You know, you talk about, you know, education, training, benefits management, this, that, and the other. And then there is sometimes, you know, smaller organizations cannot have two or three people in-house that can cover all bases. So they are recommended to go with PEOs, such as Insperity and others that are in the market. But do they provide, I mean, I would love to hear your viewpoints on that, you know, getting a PEO, do they cover all the bases, or you still have to think about, you know, they only just are more transactional in your terminology, and you still have to worry about the rest of the functions?
So in general, my opinion, PEOs check the box, and they don't go further. I do know of specifically of one or two PEOs that I would call full service, and they're much more of a partner that will do a lot of the things that I am saying. But the majority of them are, you know, check the boxes. They'll keep you compliant. They'll keep your employees with what they need, and that's it. Unfortunately, there's a large majority of organizations, that's all they want, right, out of HR, because they don't see the benefit of a truly strategic HR department. And it's very hard for a PEO to be strategic not being part of your, of your organization. Mm-hmm. So is there a role for them? Sure. But the organizations that really want to grow and succeed probably need something more than that.
Okay.
Hey, Alan, it's Carl. How you doing?
Hey, Carl.
Quick comment and a quick question. The comment is this. I think HR's role extends to before the employee ever gets onboarded and creating a presentation of a corporate culture that's desirable. I say this because the job market is so difficult right now in certain areas. But also, you know, I have three kids who just literally went through the onboarding process, and it was interesting to see compensation, of course, but kind of the package. And as one of my kids said, the vibe is here so good, I would have interned for free, mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's an important aspect of it, but that I just want to make that comment. And second, my question is, in our specialty in healthcare, there's this HR component of dealing with doctors, which is this sort of specialized class of individuals. Obviously, you all know the ups and downs of doctors. And we've experienced bad corporate culture with doctors and kind of overcoming that. Any thoughts on how to address that at an interactive level from HR's perspective?
So yeah, so that's a great question. I want to just make a comment in your comment first. Okay. because in, especially in today's market, HR really, that whole talent acquisition piece is huge, right? Roy asked a little bit about sourcing, but that's you really have to be a salesperson for your organization to be a recruiter, in the talent acquisition. You need to make them want to come work for you. You need to explain to them what's the value proposition of your organization. Why would you come work for us over another organization, right? And a lot of that isn't about salary and benefits. I mean, obviously a big part of it is, but a lot of that is about what's the culture of the organization, right? What are the values of the organization? What's the reputation of the organization, right? What you can look up on Glassdoor. What do people think of working in this organization? So that white glove service of the hiring ambassador, right? And I use those terms very carefully. The white glove service of that hiring ambassador makes that employee feel wanted and valued before they even come in the door, right? If you feel valued by this organization before you even get hired, you're going to that organization, right? So real important. And of course, it's 8 o'clock in the morning. I completely forgot the second part of your question. So
it's about how to, physician engagement.
That's right, physician. Yes.
As a class.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, great question. Right. So I had somebody say when they used to work in one of the hospitals with me, they said, "Why working in a hospital would be great if it wasn't for the doctors." So so I've actually worked with organizations, one of them very recently, with a couple of the people on this call, where we set up a separate talent acquisition area. I mean, it was a large organization just for the docs, right, to be treated differently. And that's very common, right? So that's real common. When I was up at White Plains, we had a talent acquisition. We had separated it. We had a separate area to recruit nurses, separate area to recruit doctors and onboard them. And then the other third area for everybody else. So our talent acquisition was actually divided into three. And you kind of need that, right? Just because the docs are special. Just ask them, they'll tell you. But we know they are. So you kind of need that different type of white glove hiring ambassador, right? When you're recruiting and hiring them. The thing that I'm always careful about and skeptical about is how much differently we treat them. There's a difference between acquiring a practice and hiring a physician, right? Hiring a physician, they're an employee of the organization. I've seen this a lot with hospitals, that physicians are treated the same but slightly different than any other employee in the hospital. Practices, again, is a little different because if you're acquiring a physician-owned practice, it's a lot different. But if you're bringing a physician into that practice, everyone has to follow the rules. Right. And a lot of times certain people think they don't have to. And then HR has to be the bad guy where we have that old reputation of saying, hey, you have to go to the principal's office. But it can be chaos if you don't. Right. So if everybody understands the organization and the where you are and what you're in and why. The old days of physicians or surgeons throwing scalpels across ORs, and I had one doc in my office once when I was a chief HR officer that did that, has to be dealt with. And again, otherwise chaos ensues. So I know that's not a perfect answer, Carl, but you need to treat them the same yet slightly differently.
Have you seen, Alan, health systems dramatically improve how they go about treating their staff? Or does the old adage that, the old common perception that health systems create pretty weak cultures with a lot of ill will remain as true today as it was 10, 20, 30 years ago?
So I would say in a lot of organizations, it's the same as it was 20, 30 years ago, but I've seen organizations really change the culture of the way they treat all employees and what I would say is clamping down and it has helped tremendously in the success of the organization. And again, whether it's an MSO or whether it's a 15 hospital health system, the leadership, as we all know on this call, is the most important thing. You know, there's that old saying, if the fish stinks from the head, but I always say the fish also can smell good from the head. So if they create, and people ask me all the time about creating organizational cultures, right? Unfortunately, most of the time, organizational cultures just happen, and they're based on behaviors and so forth. But I've seen leaders create organizational cultures where people are on board and understand the expectations. And I've used that term before, values, behaviors, and expectations. And it's changed it a lot. I think maybe 4 years ago, I walked into a hospital into the cafeteria, and there was actually still a table that said doctors only. And I went into the CEO's office and I said, I'm not going to be engaged in this organization if you have that table. And I left. So it's changing in some places, again, where there's strong leadership that's creating that culture. And it's all about teamwork, right? You're a team, whether you're in a single physician practice or a 20 hospital health system, you're a team. There's a team leader, but you're still a team. And you have to act as one. The fighter pilot mentality should not be in these organizations.
Understood. Thank you very much for your time, Alan. I expected a really colorful discussion, and I think we received one. So just really grateful, and also grateful for the rest of the audience for your participation. Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you all for joining me today.